Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
We are unpacking today the bizarre and infuriating twists of the Long Island serial killer case, a true crime cocktail shaken with equal parts disturbing mystery, police corruption, and a suspect who hid in plain sight for decades. After more than a decade of investigation, hitting dead ends, why was it suddenly so simple to put the pieces together? And was the biggest obstacle to justice actually the people who were supposed to provide it? Here to help us make sense of the behaviors, motivation, and the spectacular law enforcement missteps in this unsettling case, retired FBI Special Agent, Chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, Robin Dreek. Robin, let's start with something that hasn't, let's start with something here that's been bugging all of us. How does a serial killer manage to live in an unassuming life for over a decade, seemingly right under law enforcement's nose, having a wife, having kids, interacting with the public, and all the while, nobody has any idea this is the guy?
That's a great question, isn't it? And every one of these cases brings different individuals into play, and obviously suspects like Huerman, but I think with him, it's kind of unique in the fact that I think I'm going to use a phraseology here that I don't think we've used before. And that is, I think he groomed society into normalcy with his behavior, because he was doing this for such a long time. And the only reason I think that is because I think he groomed his family into what was normal for him. You know, baby steps at the very beginning, as, you know, James Clear talks about in Atomic Habits. He didn't go from zero to murder, zero to serial killer. It was a slow grooming from normalizing unhealthy behavior. And I think what was happening was, as he groomed his family into this, then he started grooming his community into this. He holds a good job as an architect. And so I think people start making excuses for behavior over periods of time, oh, it's just quirky. Oh, it's just this. So I really think he groomed society into his normal behavior so they could dismiss it until it became too much. And then it's like the dam that was holding back the floodwaters finally just opened up and went goosh. But again, a lot of missteps along the way, obviously, with investigators and things like that, that added to that ability to groom. But I really think he groomed society into his normal behavior.
Like he had a sense of where he could go, who he could groom, basically, mm-hmm. and who he could take advantage of as well, having, I guess, knowledge of, you know, the sex worker, you know, community and lack of care, I would say, from society, lack of care from law enforcement in that specific area, and really as a whole in many places. If you go after the lowest common denominator or the weakest link, you can get away with doing a lot of horrible things to people that are very innocent, may not necessarily be the people society deems as the most upstanding, but human beings that are living lives that are having trouble, that they're going down those roads. And he just seemed to take advantage of them and knew that there was a path to do it.
100%. Matter of fact, this area that he groomed and utilized for his own horrendous pleasure is, like you said, it's the sex trade. It's the sex workers. It's those women that have been so disenfranchised by society. And I looked at the numbers on this about a couple years ago now, because, you know, you and I have covered a couple serial rapists in the past, mm-hmm. and serial sex offender rapists. And the numbers are absolutely horrendous. And this is why he took advantage of this. And that is, I'm given just off the top of my head, I know it's not going to be completely accurate, but it's somewhere in the realm of, I think around 80% or 85% of all sex workers are trafficked. Mm-hmm. These women have been trafficked. This is not, you know, as society thinks, a choice women have made to do this. The vast, vast majority have been trafficked into this by horrendous individuals. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is, which even cascades even worse on top of that, I think about 90 to 95% of them have been raped. Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't think that from someone in that trade, but absolutely against their will, they've been raped. So they've been trafficked, they've been raped. And so then you take the stigma of a horrible label and you place it onto someone, you objectify the human being, so there's a lack of personalization, and it's easy for society to shove them aside. Mm-hmm. It's easy to ignore them. It's easy to take advantage of them, like Huerman was. And as we've seen allegations in law enforcement from time to time, that they have too. I have covered so many cases where, for one thing, the distrust that industry will have towards law enforcement because of either being taken advantage of by law enforcement, being ignored by law enforcement, or being arrested themselves by law enforcement, that they won't volunteer information that would be in their own best interest. Mm-hmm. And also from their own side, their own people in oversight or pimps or whatever you want to call them, the fear factor is immense with mm-hmm. this totally horrendously disenfranchised group of women. My heart goes out every time we cover a case like this.
The fact that he was able to carry this out for all of this time, and the fact that, you know, sometimes there was, allegedly, it seems like there was people that he had seen more than once, people that he never killed as well. Is there a factor in this, you know, behaviorally and psychologically, where someone like Rex Huerman, kind of like a socially outcast a bit. You know, he's not necessarily the guy that's popular at the party. He's kind of looked at, I mean, we look at him now and we profile him. We look, oh, he's kind of a big ogre guy. Before anybody knew he was or allegedly is the Long Island serial killer, if he is. You know, I'm sure he dealt with a lot of people in society and life looking at him and kind of putting him down and judging him for his looks and his personality and such. And then you have that same sort of thing going on with the disenfranchised women who have been trafficked, who have gotten into the sex trade because they don't have any other choice. Is there like a level there where there's some sort of commiserating, some sort of, you know, almost trauma bonding that goes on that allows both of those individuals to have a certain level of trust with one another that would then enable Rex allegedly to carry out the deeds that he was able to do because both kind of being outcasts, if you will, in society?
Maybe it's an interesting thought. I think definitely a potential linkage there would be unhealthy behaviors attract other unhealthy behaviors, and sure, unhealthy people do. So I think, you know, that's part of it. So there's a normalcy from the type of clients you'll have. There's a normalcy from the type of women that were now accepted in his life. Because when you desensitize your environment towards your behavior and towards your proclivities, like you allegedly was doing by having, I mean, decades ago started this behavior allegedly with sex trafficked women, mm-hmm, you know, desensitizing his own family, so it becomes part of the normal behavior. That's definitely part of it. But trauma bonding as well, yeah, potentially, because the women that he was targeting, again, vast majority, well, I'm going to say in the 90% mm-hmm, have been trauma bonded to, yeah, whoever's controlling them at that point as well. So they're very used to it, unfortunately.
Yeah. How, I mean, obviously it's a slow cook for trying to get your family to go along with you on, and I'm not saying that the family knew what he was up to, but obviously, I mean, just, I mean, look at the home that they lived in, look at the kind of hoarding type lifestyle that they had. And just the, it's almost like a view into Rex's mind, if you will, with a reflection of the home and the environment that he surrounded himself in. Chaos, a lot of chaos. It seems that it's probably not all that difficult to get your family to go down this road with you if you slowly inch them there. It's the frog in the boiling pot of water and such. Is that what we saw going on here with Rex Heuermann, likely, the way that everyone at the beginning, I mean, including us, looking at Asa, even looking at the adult kids going, how did you not know something was going on here? And I don't to this day know if she did. I certainly have questions about it. It seems rather weirdly inconvenient that she was out of town every time that these things were going on, and they seem to have this own kind of duality of separate lives. But if that's the norm, that's the norm for you. And I guess that would be in a way that you don't see what is going on behind the curtain.
Yeah, you used the phrase going down the road with you. I don't think I would use the exact going down the road with you thought process here. Mm-hmm. What I think might have been going on is, remember, all of us are extremely predictable, all human beings. And that is, we crave and we will do all behaviors we can to feel safe. And so I think what was most likely happening, again, subjective third party conjecture on my part, not licensed psychologist, sure, and all that. But I think what was happening is if you have a wife and children that feel unsafe because of the environments or the behaviors of your spouse, your father, and all these things that you're slowly groomed into, what you're going to do is you're going to start getting reps at ignoring behavior, because observing and acknowledging that behavior would make you feel unsafe, would make you feel less than, it would do all the things that would psychologically harm you. And so we naturally start doing things to ignore that behavior. So when you start getting a muscle memory of how to ignore behaviors that you're observing that you've been slowly groomed into, that's exactly what I think was happening. I think they were, everything's a choice, but I don't think they were consciously at the point at the very end choosing to ignore behavior or going down a road with him. I just think they had a long decades worth of reps of learning how to feel better about themselves and feel safe in a completely unhealthy environment.
Yeah, I mean, it's survival at the end of the day, yeah, and your mind will adapt to do however it needs to get by. Speaking of unhealthy behavior and I guess grooming to a certain extent, let's talk about James Burke. He was the guy who was there as part of the original investigation. He was in the police back then, the chief, when all this was going on actively, at least when it seems a lot of the murders took place. And it seems many of them did not get the attention and the manpower that they needed to be further investigated. Obviously, Burke has his own sets of issues that he was charged and arrested for and convicted on. He certainly fits a profile of someone active in that community, of someone who may not want his own choices being exposed if someone were to go down the road of Rex Heuermann. I guess, how does someone like that enable a department and enable investigators to not investigate something like this. It's obviously people are there. They want to keep their jobs and all of that. That may just simply be the answer right there. People are going to be looking out for their own self-interest. But at the same point, it's not like these things were happening in the dark. Other people had to have seen that, hey, we're completely turning a blind eye to these sort of things. How does someone in his type of position at that time, you know, gain other people's trust and don't have others dissenting, saying, hey, no, we really need to fix this. We need to be looking at these things, because it went on for so long in that sort of a structure of law enforcement. How do you think that was playing out, where this was able to go on for so long without a true in-depth investigation?
Here's a possibility. Again, don't know because we're not in the department, but
yeah.
In law enforcement, and think about for yourselves, doing your own thought experiment in any job. I mean, Tony, even you know, with all the great content and cases you cover, you have more coming in than you probably have the ability to put out. And so it's the same thing in law enforcement. When I was at FBI headquarters and I was managing counterintelligence investigations around the country, there's no way I could actually put everything as priority one, because there's just too much. The volume was too high. So sure. What I'm thinking of most likely in these cases, every department has many more cases and investigations that need to be covered than they have resources and personnel for. And so you prioritize and you stack and you restack every day. Mm-hmm. You know, what am I going to get arrested for if I don't cover? What am I going to get fired for if I don't cover? And what's a great thing that I have to cover because it's the righteous thing to do? And so you kind of have those three piles. And every day restacking these piles based on what's the most critical thing. Now, when you have a boss above you that is supposedly helping you restack this pile, because you still have lots of righteous work to do, mm-hmm. and they might be help you rationalize how we're not going to pay attention to this case because, oh, it's just a sex worker case, or we have all these, instead of saying what not to cover, he might have been saying, hey, here's what's really important to cover first. And mm-hmm. once you get done with that, well, then we'll move to this one. Then we'll move to this one. So I don't think, again, if I was him going that deep context from his point of view, if I want someone to not cover something I'm trying to cover in my own footsteps, it's alerting when you tell someone not to do something. It's less alerting when you need them to do something else. And so instead of taking something away, so in other words, don't do this investigation here, that's alerting. I would mm-hmm. say, hey, you need to do this, this, and this first. And not even talk about that one. So I think he's probably overloading in one area to keep him distracted so he doesn't go to that area. That would be my context, because he's a smart guy.
Yeah. Well, that
might
makes
be
sense.
Horrendous.
Yeah.
But that's smart. That's what these really horrendous people will do.
Yeah, it's by omission, basically. It's not. And it's lying by omission, it's distracting by omission.
I think it's really keeping his people distracted with other righteous work rather mm-hmm. than covering this. And downplaying it, rationalizing it, or not just, again, the last thing you want to do if you're trying to cover your own tracks in an area is bring attention to that area. So the best way not to bring attention to that area is keep them focused on something else. Mm-hmm. So that's what I think he's probably doing. He's probably keeping them focused on other investigations.
And yeah, I mean, I guess for his own best interest of what he was involved in, that makes sense. But many departments, it's a social construct. It's how we view this in our society. I'm not saying it's right, but it is how people view this sort of work, as, you know, well, they almost view people in this area as less than, as, you know, sometimes not even treating them like human beings, you know, more care sometimes for animals than they do for people who are in these horrific situations. And at the end of the day, victims of rape, of sex trafficking, of all these horrible things, these people are victims and they are trying to survive at the end of the day, and they need help. They don't need to be run over a time or two again by some self-righteous warrior who wants to say, you're right, you're wrong, and I deem you morally reprehensible or whatever, which is what we normally get. From an aspect of law enforcement and trying to get behind all of this, trying to get ahead of all of this and get to the deep roots of some of these problems, not only in the sex trafficking area, but other areas of crime, into the drug trade, into so many other things. Sex workers seem to be kind of low-hanging fruit here that could easily lead to other areas and systemically get the tentacles into other areas where one could open up other investigations and pull more people down. It seems it's kind of an easy way, if you were in law enforcement, to enter into that realm and, okay, get in here, get this information, and then find out more people that you can take down that are tearing apart society and destroying lives. Why don't they look at that more in that way? Why don't we investigate things in that way when it's right in front of us, but it seems a social construct of, oh, these are icky people, it's not worth our time, when really you look into that area, you're going to find so much more if you go down those paths.
So from the law enforcement professionals I know,
yeah,
they are so pro trying to do exactly what you said you need to do, you know, and you're right in a sense that it's low hanging fruit that we know these horrendous things are going on surrounding this industry. So you think that the prosecutions would be easier to do. But the most challenging hurdle, because I've worked with departments that have tried to crack the nut on this, and they are such good, caring. I mean, law enforcement professionals, by and large, you know, we tend to see the negative ones when covering some of these cases because they're the root of some of these cases. But the vast, vast majority of law enforcement professionals are so caring and just compassionate towards everyone, including mm-hmm. the sex trade, because they know how, just like my numbers showed you,
yeah.
they know where it comes from. So there's a huge amount of compassion. The greatest challenge, Tony, is in every investigation, the most critical thing you need for success is confidential human sources.
Mm-hmm.
Confidential human sources tell you where to focus your subpoenas. They tell you where to focus your technical expertise. They tell you everything you need to know for a case. And this is the most challenging industry to develop confidential human sources in because of fear.
Mm-hmm.
The women involved have such a fear. They have fear of the people that are controlling them, of their pimps or their handlers or whatever they're calling them on their side. And they have fear of law enforcement, of not trusting them, not to arrest them as well and take yeah. them down or turn them in. And so a couple of cases and operations I consulted a number of years ago was actually out in California. And they actually asked me, one of the departments, I think it was LAPD I was working with, you know, they were trying to do just this. They're trying to get better confidential human sources. And it's possible, but you don't develop trust like this. Trust mm-hmm. takes time. Trust takes a pattern of behavior where someone feels they can share with you their most horrendous vulnerabilities that they have, their insecurities, their fears, their traumas, and not be judged so they can feel safe to share things with you. And that's what it would take in these situations. That takes time. That takes patience. But when you're dealing with then bosses above you that have a high degree in need for speed, we need collars, we need turnover, we need cases and prosecutions like this, it doesn't give the investigator the time he needs to develop that kind of trust to get the kind of sources they need in the sex worker industry.
And is so that,
that is, yeah. it's one of the greatest challenges.
I mean, does that come down to lack of manpower? We don't have enough investigators that can focus on more longer term things where it's going to take longer to build those relationships because there's only so many people for so many crimes. And at the end of the day, the public wants accountability. They want to see the results now, even though it does take time to get them. And there's just not enough resources to focus on this the way that it would produce better results.
There's a few things. So there's always a manpower and resources issue, but it also requires a very soft touch, requires really seasoned investigators that have time on the street. They have time doing human interactions. You know, someone who's a fantastic interviewer knows how to develop compassionate, empathetic rapport without judging. You know, understanding that these are the individuals you're going to be communicating with, then it also requires a vast amount of patience from the prosecution side, from the investigation side, from executive management to say, hey, this is going to be a program. It's going to be a longstanding program. We're going to need time to develop the competent human sources we need to actually make a dent in this. And so it's to me, it'd be a three-pronged approach from that point of view.
I mean, should there be more focus on ways to create essentially like a safe space, if you will, for women who have been trafficked or women who are in this trade, that they can come forward and not have to fear that they're going to be arrested, that they don't have to fear that, okay, they're going to tell their story and it's like, okay, well, go back out there. Good luck. And your pimp can find you and all these people can go after you once you've basically snitched on whoever you are snitching on. More of a safe system where, okay, almost like witness protection to a certain degree of, okay, come in. We are going to protect you going forward. We can get you out of here. We can get you far away from these people where you don't have to worry about your safety. We will relocate you and create a system of that where there can be more sense of safety and coming forward with information that can take the bad guys down rather than this being this, I'm afraid to talk to you because I'm going to go have to live my life here still. And I don't want to go to jail. Not to say to give it a free pass that, you know, nobody can get arrested in this if you're participating, but something where the information they can provide far outweighs any reason to arrest any of these women for what they're doing to try and survive or are being forced into.
You know, I'm going to have a lot of conjecture on this one as well.
Yeah.
I don't have any names or numbers off the top of my head, but there are a large number of departments doing exactly what you just said. And because okay. I know we're going to get some people reaching out to us saying, well, we do it.
Yeah.
And so, and I know they are because I wouldn't even be able to think about it unless I've heard these cases that they are doing it. It's being able to share those best practices amongst other departments. And they do that at conferences and such on this type of thing. And I know we keep saying that women are being arrested for you know, dealing with the sex trade. But believe it or not, so here I am, again, I'm putting my investigator hat on. I'm not about to arrest anyone that's been trafficked, you know, because mm-hmm. if you look at how they got into the trade, it's not that they're doing illegal activities, it's that they were, illegal activity was done against them.
Yeah.
And so a lot of great investigation, great departments are doing just that. They're not arresting women for being trafficked because that's how it started. And so that's why there is a lot of patience. And so law enforcement has seen it. But again, what it takes is I hate using such a flippant term, but it takes flavor of the day because every jurisdiction has a new flavor of the day that we got to make a dent here, or a new politician is trying to get elected. And this was their platform here. That's what it really keeps coming down to and driving where the focus is. It's politicians that are being elected. It's social media or media outlets that are covering certain cases in a certain way. And all of a sudden that becomes the clickbait for someone to focus on this.
Yeah.
So it's, I like keeping things really simple at, you know, from the start point, start at one single point, but this is one of those complex things that there's a lot of wickets that I think need to be aligned here. So let's start at the top. The top is elected officials have to make this their platform, because when they're elected into these positions, that platform will then get trickled down. Because when if a local politician is elected into a position and that becomes their platform, that part of my platform is to end sex trafficking. And end human trafficking, because again, this is not even second. End human trafficking, because that impacts fentanyl. It impacts the drug trade. It impacts all these other things. So they can tie it there, and then you can have that trickle on down, and you hit all the nuances and tendrils that go out from that. I think that would start making a big difference.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. WATER to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
I can't tell you how often I hear, oh, I'm a little OCD. I like things neat. That's not OCD. I'm Howie Mandel, and I know this because I have OCD. Actual OCD causes relentless, unwanted thoughts. What if I did something terrible and forgot? What if I'm a bad person? Why am I thinking this terrible thing? It makes you question absolutely everything, and you'll do anything to feel better. OCD is debilitating, but it's also highly treatable with the right kind of therapy. Regular talk therapy doesn't cut it. OCD needs specialized therapy. That's why I want to tell you about NoCD. NoCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for OCD. Their licensed therapists provide specialized therapy virtually, and it's covered by insurance for over 155 million Americans. If you think you might be struggling with OCD, visit NoCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call and learn more. That's NoCD.com.